This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Welcome to the Intelligence Squared podcast. I'm producer Catherine Hughes. In her new book, Hags, The Demonization of Middle-Aged Women, author Victoria Smith confronts the disdain and vitriol she encountered as a woman entering midlife, and she dissects the ageism and misogyny that have historically plagued older women, shedding light on its resurgence in recent years. In conversation with Hadley Freeman from the Sunday Times, they examine the societal dismissal of women who dare to exist beyond the confines of youth and desirability, rendering them seemingly superfluous. Here's Hadley with more.
As a fully paid-up member of the Kingdom of Hagdom, I'm completely thrilled to be talking to Victoria Smith, author of Hags, this evening. Victoria, I'm sure as many of you out there know, is a very accomplished and brilliant journalist. She blogs under the name Glosswitch, and I've been reading her for years, and I just completely devoured Hags. So thank you so much, Victoria, for taking the time to talk to us this evening.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, congratulations on the book. I wondered if we could start with, I read recently that you are part of a trend. Janice Turner of the Times recently cited you alongside Kathleen Stock, Mary Harrington, Julie Bindle, Louise Perry, and Helen Joyce as being at the vanguard of what she calls material feminism, which she defines as a feminism that asserts the primacy of biological reality on women's lives. And obviously citing that in particular in relation to Hags. Do you agree with that definition?
I mean, I think that's quite a diverse group, but I do think something's happened in feminism in the past, say, 10 years that has driven a lot of us to assert the primacy of the body much more than we were doing. I think because there's been this trend towards, I don't know, sex denialism, flight from the body, whatever you want to call it, which has always been there a bit in the sense that that's the way some women have seen liberation as kind of denying the body. It's got much more intense in recent years. And I think there are many of us that feel that we've had to like choose which way to jump, to either kind of deny that the body has any importance or to actually really insist on it and really interrogate it in a way that we haven't had to do earlier. I think before there was a kind of assumption that the body did matter, but you could downplay it a bit. But I think we can't now. But I think that's quite interesting and quite exciting for feminism at the moment.
You write about this in the book. There's fear that if women talk about the differences in their bodies, that means giving up equality. So how do we balance that if we say actually women aren't as strong as men? You know, we do have these physical differences, and yet we should still be allowed to do all the same jobs they can. I mean, I use the word allowed there slightly with caution. But how do we balance that acknowledging difference but still demanding equality?
I think we really have to get away from the idea that difference means inferiority, which I think that gets really instilled into women and girls. And from quite an early age, I think I felt it very much when I was growing up, that kind of ideas about female intellectual or moral or physical inferiority were always there whenever you admitted or focused on any physical difference between women and men. And there's this fear of celebrating anything that women can do that men can't do, because that will be used against us. But I think as long as you are in denial of it, I think there's always this little voice in you that is thinking, well, maybe we are inferior. Maybe, you know, if you're going to deny how important our physical differences are, I think it shows a kind of lack of confidence in the fact that we are just as valuable and just as important and in no way inferior to men. So, you know, I think you have to kind of celebrate the things we can do, but also be really careful to analyse the differences and what they really mean, because there are so many false interpretations put onto difference. You know, this idea that men are stronger than women, I think it's really important if we're looking at something like male violence, but it doesn't mean that their bodies are in some essential way better than ours. You know, they're not. I mean, we give birth.
And also, you write so interestingly in the book about your own personal history of trying to deny the body. And I think there is that real interesting irony in there has been this long history, like you say, of women our age, older, you know, insisting we're the same, we can do whatever boys can. And yet the way we try to deny our bodies is often extremely bodily led. Like, you and I both had anorexia. Other women, you know, try to, you know, the only way you can prove it is basically punishing your body. So in the end, you can't get away from your body.
Yeah. And this kind of denial of the body, it's on the one hand, it's this trying to prove you're just as good, that you're this kind of, I think I quoted Maria Hornbacher's Wasted, where she talks about wanting to be this pure mind, this pure brain, and, you know, not have anything to do with the body at all. But actually, this denial is very feminine in some way. It's very submissive. It, in the end, it's not really asserting yourself. It's denying your own growth. And you see this, you know, now I think, you know, I've written quite a bit about the use of binders and the way that it's crushing yourself to be considered of the same status as the male people around you. And they're not crushing themselves. They're just being in their bodies. And that's what we should be.
So let's talk about this path towards the body denialism that we see now with so many women. Because like you say, this began with a kind of insistence on equality. And maybe we could trace that back to the second wave feminism. And then things really stepped up a gear in the past decade. Can you tell me how you see what's happened in terms of women and their bodies and the disconnect between them?
Well, I think this kind of denial of the body, you know, you can trace it back really far in terms of women starving themselves, either for some kind of religious transcendence, this kind of idealization, or just trying to be considered equal. My own experience of anorexia was kind of, you know, not wanting to get breasts, not wanting to be considered an object, wanting to be just a body, just this gender neutral state that I considered in some ways kind of superior to girls who just allowed themselves to kind of fall into that becoming feminine or female trap. But I think now it's kind of really ramped up a lot, because I think partly through online spaces and through the strength of gender identity taking primacy over talking about the importance of biological sex, you know, it's this idea that you can be whoever you want to be and you can't let the body hold you back and you can be beyond the body. And there's this misuse of the term biological essentialism, which I think earlier it was used by feminists to mean the fact that you are born female should not dictate your status in a hierarchy. It shouldn't mean you have to do certain roles. Whereas now it's the fact that you are born female is almost like shouldn't mean that you are female. You know, it shouldn't mean that you have to go, have to menstruate or get breasts or just grow normally and thrive if you don't want to.
Now, let's talk about your path into hagdom. Do you think that the prejudice against middle-aged women has gotten worse than before? Or is it that you and I are noticing it more because we are now middle-aged women?
I mean, it's kind of hard to disentangle the two. I certainly think that for me, a huge part is noticing it more because I'm older. I mean, it really is this kind of like, oh, God, I never thought that happened to me thing. And I have really distinct memories of when I was younger, kind of seeing within my understanding of feminism, the kind of feminism I came to in the early 90s as a young woman, kind of seeing it as a pathway out of ending up in the same position as women my mother's age, as a kind of, I won't end up like you because I'm different, because I'm liberated, because I have all these opportunities and it'll make me not like you. And it was almost a feminism that had a kind of misogyny embedded in it that didn't see a connection with older women, but saw feminism as a way of kind of shooting off in a different direction to them. And it's funny, kind of a few years ago, you know, I've quoted Adrienne Rich quite a lot in the book because Of Woman Born, it had huge impact on me, you know, but I only read it when I was 40 and it was like written in, you know, when I was one. But she writes about looking at her mother and thinking, I'll have children, I'll get married, but I'll do it differently to you. I won't be the same as you. And she writes about this constant image that you kind of look up to the older woman but think, that won't be me, I'll do it better, I'll do it differently. So there's that, and I think that's kind of quite an ongoing pattern. But I do think at this particular point in time, there is a particular antipathy towards older women within what claims to be progressive feminist culture, that, you know, this idea that the older woman is on the wrong side of the history. She's this kind of repository for all these bad old-fashioned beliefs about sex, the body, reproduction, and you can kind of implant all these old beliefs on her, and this generation of older women will die out, and the generation that replaces her will be kind of more liberal, more open-minded, have fewer boundaries, won't say no so much, and won't be so damn annoying. And that's, I think that's really prevalent, and it's there in, you know, the use of terms like Karen, which, you know, is quite a complicated thing to write about. I think this idea of the entitled, difficult older woman and criticising her as a feminist act is very powerful at the moment.
And why is that so common with women? I don't see men sort of slagging off the male figureheads that came before specifically, but it's like with every new generation of, I mean, what we can loosely call feminism, it's younger women really disowning the ones who were there before. I mean, Germaine Greer is an obvious example, and really kind of scorning the older women and trying to be, we're not like them, we're the cool ones. And I'm sure I did that in my 20s. I can't remember any specific examples, but I'm sure I did. And now I see it now with young women in their 20s. You know, that's a Karen, I'm a cool girl. Why does this happen among women so much?
I think it's this idea of constant reinvention and this denial of any kind of legacy or history to women. You know, it's like men are kind of always adding stones to the edifice, standing on the shoulders of giants, sort of building. And the metaphor we have is like a wave that kind of crashes and recedes. And we're always having to like build things up again from the start. And one thing I think it's this idea of fearing that, this fear of being, that women are actually losers, that women are actually inferior, and that we need to start again and we need to kind of prove ourselves still because we haven't done anything yet. And one thing that I felt the more I worked on the book was that this desire to disidentify from older women is very much connected to this idea that women don't really have a history, women don't really have a legacy, women haven't really done anything yet. And so each generation of feminists is like, our moment is about to come, everything's around the corner, we're just about to prove ourselves. One example that I used was the statue of Mary Wollstonecraft, which doesn't actually show Mary Wollstonecraft. It shows this like naked Barbie doll type emerging from all these like formless blobs, you know, this kind of like, we're not there yet, we're about to prove ourselves, we're nearly good enough. And actually, I think that comes from a very deep sense of a fear that we are just inferior to men. I think it gets very deeply embedded in women because we're aware of our difference and we kind of want to deny it because we're frightened that it means we're inferior, and we're not.
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed. So you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Now, I want to get into what's really spurred on this moment in particular. But before I do that, I had to say, you know, there's something about the cover of this book and the subtitle that is familiar from another book. And I wondered if there is a connection to another book by another writer that you wanted to make with this book.
Well, I mean, yeah, there was kind of, I did have in my mind, sorry, Chavs by Owen Jones, because I think what he did very effectively there was pointed out that a marginalised group were being targeted and blamed and stigmatised from a position that was supposedly moral, that kind of it was fine to make fun of working class people because actually they were really bad, and that, you know, so it was legitimate. And I think there's something, a kind of similar, well, it's fine to make fun of middle-aged women because they're bad, they're bigots, they're, you know, and they're on the wrong side of history. And there's this kind of elitist position on it that, you know, they don't know what's going on. And yes, there was that, but I also... Yeah, I think he probably wouldn't see that connection himself.
Because you mentioned before about one of the differences with the current moment is seeing people in allegedly progressive spheres really punching on middle-aged women, or whether they call them middle-aged, you know, middle class, white, you know, anything to imply that there's that this one group of women has enormous privilege and therefore we can dump everything on them. And that has been to me one of the biggest shocks of the past, what is it now, 7-8 years, is seeing these men really beating up on women. Do you think that so many progressive men have just been waiting for a moment when they could do this with impunity? Because that's what it kind of feels like.
I think they're loving it. I think some men, it's quite shocking in some ways how much some men seem to have really embraced this idea that actually you can be really misogynistic and really aggressive and even justify violence against women if you can kind of put them in this Karen box or TERF box, and if you found the right name to call them, then it's totally fine. And so much of it as well, it's kind of to legitimize things that they want for themselves. You know they're not interested in the pension inequality, they're not interested in the pay gap, they're not interested in who's doing the unpaid labor, but they're really interested in sex work is work and in calling you a massive bigot if you do anything that questions their right to pay for sex, for instance. Yeah, it's they've chosen particular causes that they call feminist, which actually just meet their own needs, and they are really embracing attacking women who disagree. And I think there is, you know, you get the sense that certain men have, they're on the progressive team, they're on the leftist team, and it's always been part of the package has always been, you've got to be a feminist, you've got to kind of go along with, you've got to be nice to the ladies or whatever. But it's kind of now that that's changed a bit, you know, they're quite happy about it. And I mean, it's not completely new. I mean, if you think Robin Morgan's Goodbye to All That, you know, and a lot of second wave feminism, you can see that some of it came out of rage from women at not being included in men's activism in the 60s and early 70s. But yeah, it's really quite powerful now, I think.
And also the whole gender identity movement is kind of founded on a very regressive idea of what a woman is. And inevitably, as you say in the book, middle-aged women kind of don't fit into that. You know, so much of what, you know, this idea of like a woman gender identity is now basically being feminine. And middle-aged women have gone beyond that. We're not feminine. We're mainly pissed off.
Yeah, and it's kind of someone who sees woman as a kind of identity doesn't really see, I don't think they see themselves as a postmenopausal woman. You know, that, you know, it is completely embedded in this idea of femininity, which is so artificial. And there is real annoyance, I think, at women who don't conform to that because they're spoiling this whole idea of what a woman is that is very much based around male ideas and male. I find it interesting that you can kind of trace it back, even if you look at things that were written about the menopause in the 60s when HRT was first coming out. You had these psychiatrists and doctors writing that, you know, when women hit menopause, they just stop being proper women. They become like eunuchs and they need treatment. And, you know, I'm not against HRT. I know a lot of women who've really benefited from it. But this place where they were basically saying that if a woman's not feminine, she's not a woman. She's just this thing. And that idea is still very powerful, I think.
And also the HRT thing is really interesting because obviously there's been this slew of books about the menopause that have come out recently by well-known women such as Davinia McCall and I think Mariella Frostrup, and they're all very pro-HRT. And like you, I know lots of women who've been helped by it, but you do think at a certain point, at what point can a woman just like be? Our bodies don't need to be pumped up with a hormone that we're not getting anymore. Is there are you just supposed to be on HRT till you're 90 years old? Like, I don't really understand what the argument is anymore.
No, I don't either. And it's this idea that unlike with men, something goes drastically wrong with us when we hit middle age. And I think it's quite uncomfortable. It coincides with this time when we're meant to suddenly be really unattractive, that we're meant to become invisible, that we're meant to be more quiet. And when we do speak up, we're called entitled. I worry about narratives that are really obsessed with correcting middle-aged women, even if they're done in a kind of self-help way, because narratives about self-help and pampering and, you know, me time, they're always quite double-edged for women. You know, are they about making you feel better about yourself, or are they about making you more acceptable for a society that wants women to be a particular way?
Exactly. I mean, you write in the book about tweakments and stuff, which is something I have managed to totally resist, as anyone can tell by looking at my face, even though I am like, you know, I live in London and I'm surrounded by places that offer them. But like you, I just don't see why putting needles in my face would actually make me feel better. I mean, unless my feeling better about myself is dependent on other people telling me I look better. And I feel like at the age of 45, like I've gone beyond that. Like I don't need people to tell me I look better. I just don't have needles stuck in my face.
It's really difficult because you're always aware that you will be judged on how you look as a woman. And I think this is another thing that's come through in this supposedly progressive politics that actually has a really misogynistic edge. There's a lot of comments about middle-aged women's appearance that are meant to be kind of showing that these women are bad politically, this kind of idea that, oh, she's got a Karen haircut, she's got turf bangs, she's got a wrinkly face because she's filled with hate kind of thing. She's all saggy because she's eaten up with like resentment at the fact that sex workers are more attractive than her. You know, you see all these sort of messages that combine not being attractive with no longer having political relevance and actually being meant to be quiet. And they're very kind of slippery because it's like, oh, we're not really judging you for how you look. We're judging you for your politics, but we're just like kind of expressing it by criticizing how you look as well. And I find it, I mean, I've not had, as you probably see, I've not had any injections or anything, but I do feel self-conscious about how I look and kind of this, and you get this kind of you would have those opinions looking the way you do, like, which, you know, and I know it's nonsense, but at the same time you are aware that in certain circumstances how you look is used to discredit and devalue your views.
It's true, but I also feel, and maybe I just say this to console myself because I'm too cheap and too scared of pain to go off and have Botox, but I feel even if I looked really attractive, I wouldn't be allowed to have the views that I have. Like, they would still be unacceptable, even if I looked like, I don't even know who's considered an attractive 40-something anymore, Julianne Moore. Like, I saw an interview with Amanda Holden in the Saturday Times this weekend, and the whole interview is about, isn't this amazing? She's still really hot, even though she's 52. But the only thing she was allowed to talk about was some vitamin drink that she was promoting. And I thought, well, I'd rather look like an old hag and talk about my opinions than have to be all plumped up and talk about a vitamin drink. So if those are my options, I'll go for hagdom. Sorry, that wasn't a question. That was just a rant. Now, I've had loads of friends texting me who've already read your book. I have to say, Victoria, I've had so many conversations about your book with friends over the past few weeks. Everyone I know has just been longing for a book called Hags. And the main thing they'll want to know is how to talk to their daughters about this, how to stop the sexism that young women feel towards older women, and how to kind of prepare their daughters, and also how to help their daughters fight against it. Do you have any tips for that?
It is really hard. I mean, one of the things I sort of wrote about in the book going through was trying to imagine how my younger self would have responded to what I'm writing now. You know, if you told me sort of 30 years ago, or one day you'll write a book on feminism, I would have imagined it would be one of those like, you go, girl, show the second wave feminists what bigot hags they are. I would never have imagined I'd come out with something like this. But it's kind of... It is really difficult to talk across that divide. And my mum died when I started writing the book. And I find it quite sad that I can't really talk to her about it now. And, you know, we could never really talk across our different views on feminism and women's roles and who we want to be. And it's always very hard to kind of look at other women and understand the compromises they've made and understand how they got to the position that they got to. And I only have sons, so I'm not really confronting this as well. And I do sort of think it's...
sons are the same. Yeah, I mean, you need to tell them too, to not just assume that middle-aged women are irrelevant and, you know, have nothing to offer anymore, basically.
Yeah, I feel with my sons, there's kind of maybe a layer that's not there. When I can talk to them about gender identity and those kind of issues, and they might disagree with me, but... there's not a fear of turning into me. There's not that extra kind of, I've got to disidentify from you in the same way because, there's a different relationship there. I think helping girls to feel confident in themselves rather than confronting them with your own particular views is maybe helpful. But I think it's really difficult because you have to hold... The women I know who are dealing with that, they have to kind of swallow a lot of their own pride and wait it out and kind of be very patient and kind of be second place to while their daughters work things out with their own bodies and relationships with the world. And I think that's really hard because you want desperately for your children to see that you're a person too, and they have to at some point, but it's...
It does seem quite striking to me, and thinking back on my own relationship with my parents, and that daughters kind of need to disown their mothers or almost hate their mothers for a bit in order to grow up. Whereas I'm not sure if the same is true of sons and fathers.
Yeah. I was thinking about the Gloria Steinem's essay that she wrote on sort of younger women and older women and conservatism. She said something about a rebellious act. You know, a really rebellious act for a son is rejecting the father, whereas a really rebellious act for the daughter is actually embracing the mother and kind of feeling close to her. And I thought that was, I found that quite compelling because I think there is so much around daughters that actually encourages them to disidentify and distance themselves.
Which is then carried out in a kind of on a writ large scale in the way they then disown older feminists, basically. It's kind of its own form of matricide. And that point is backed up by Kaz in the audience, which prefaces it with comments, not a question. And Kaz says, I'm almost 68. I too used to feel that I would not end up being old. Unfortunately, experience has demonstrated that the only difference between me and younger women is time. I am called Karen, and I find the whole thing incredibly distressing, especially when used by younger women. That is an interesting point about how many younger women join in on it. And is that, do you think that comes from a place of almost self-defense, or is it kind of like trying to prove that they are, you know, that are kind of disowning that they will be older one day, or just trying to reassure people around them that they're not on the team with these middle-aged women?
I think there is a lot of self-protection in there, and also maybe a kind of, I think for younger women who are privileged as well, in the same way this kind of Karen figure is, you know, if you're white and middle class and straight, and I think there are so many narratives around you kind of getting you to examine your privilege. I think sort of having a go at the Karen figure, which is basically women like your mum, is a kind of self-defense fit. And it's also a way of kind of divesting your sort of distancing yourself from privilege that you can't actually help but inherit in some way. You know, this is your heritage, it's coming down to you, and you will become that woman. And it, I think it's a kind of attempt to push away from it and say that you'll be different and that you'll be better. But you have to kind of, you have to own it, and you have to own your own past as well and your future.
And that brings me to my inevitably favorite chapter in the book, Wrong Side of History, Hag, which looks at the demonizing of women, and in particular over the past 8 years. Do you think that this movement is kind of changing, that the Karen slur is losing its currency? You know, we've seen Keir Starmer walking back from gender identity. You know, it's gone from being a given that, you know, we all have to respect this gender identity thing and that middle-aged women are just the worst, to slowly a kind of move to the center. Or do you think it's, you know, that Pandora's box has been opened and we can't get it back in?
I think women are getting more confident in answering back to this. I think when the Karen slur, whatever you want to call it, first came out, you know, it was very difficult to kind of criticize it, because if you criticize women being called Karens, that makes you a Karen. So then, like, that just proves you're really bad. But then we can't all be Karens. We can't all be TERFs. You know, at some point, you have to admit that so many women from so many diverse backgrounds can't all have suddenly embraced these kind of evil, stereotyped ideas. You know, it's just not plausible. And at the same time, I think it maybe surprises some politicians. I think they maybe thought women would just shut up and forget about this and it would all go away, and they didn't have to look at it very closely or think very closely about it. I suppose the thing I found quite annoying at the moment with gender identity is that I think for years women have been pointing out, and they've been doing lots of research and writing and speaking against a backdrop of a lot of threats and a lot of misrepresentation. And yet they've been treated either as vile bigots or these kind of mumsnet idiots who should just stick to talking about baby food. And then suddenly, when you have politicians such as Nicola Sturgeon coming up against the reality of what things like gender self-ID mean, it's as though nobody ever mentioned it before. It's as though that can't have been what the women were talking about, because they were just the stupid women. They were just the stupid Karens, you know. And I don't think there'll ever be a point at which anyone says, oh, actually, none of these women were idiots. You know, they weren't all wrong side of history bigots and were really sorry. I don't think there'll be an apology for it. But I think there would be a backtracking from the kind of ideas that these women were challenging. And it's going to be just like housework, isn't it? Lots of women have done it, but it's kind of invisible. And, you know, there's no reward for it. And some man will come along and take all the credit and then say, why didn't the women say anything earlier?
And do you think this movement that we're seeing now, on the one hand, has kind of radicalized a lot of progressive men to show their misogyny, but has also radicalized a lot of women to embrace a kind of more grassroots feminism than has been around for a while?
I think so, yeah. And I think it has, as we said at the start, I think it's made a lot of us think a lot more about the body and what it means in relation to feminism in a way that we weren't doing before. You know, I think, you know, maybe 10, 15 years ago, I would think of feminism in terms of, you know, abortion rights, male violence is bad, or, you know, I'd have these ideas, but I wouldn't want to like really interrogate where all this was coming from, how it started, how it might end. And I think now that there's some feminism that's really kind of digging deep into these ideas of difference and similarity, and what I think it is really interesting and really exciting. And I think what I'd really like is for it to lead to just women really valuing their bodies more and feeling more at home in their bodies. Because I think not feeling at home in your body and being made to feel, even in ways you don't articulate, that it's inferior, it's a major part of like what facilitates misogyny and the kind of internalized misogyny and distancing between women and fear of aging. I think the fear of aging and body hatred are very connected.
And in terms of the body, I think it's so interesting in the book, like I hadn't even thought about this. You point out, you know, that old Freudian theory that little girls are jealous or sad that they don't have a penis. They're jealous of boys for having a penis. And then looking at what the NHS has done recently, you know, referring to breastfeeding as chest feeding and de-sexing, all the language around pregnancy and childbirth. It does feel like that envy has so turned around. It's like this thing that women can do, which is reproduce, that has to be taken away from them. Like the first time I really noticed how weirdly misogynistic the kind of the gender movement had become was when Monroe Bergdorf said that women shouldn't center their vaginas or something on a march to defend abortion rights or something. And I thought, oh, wow, we can't even have that on. We can't even have our bodies on an abortion march. And I think that is what I find really upsetting about the gender movement, is it's kind of trying to take women's bodies away from them in a way rather than instilling pride in them.
Yeah, I think it takes away the continuity. Like if you divide your experiences of oppression that is linked to your sex to like one-off events such as birthing people or gestators or chest feeders, you know, you deny the fact that we have this story with our bodies and it's continuous, and kind of the discrimination you face, but also the pleasures you have in your body, that they are part of this continuous story about being female. And I find it really frustrating that when you try to articulate that, you're sometimes told, oh, but if you make women into people with uteruses, you just think women are walking uteruses. And that says something about what the person thinks about people with uteruses. It doesn't say something about what I think women are. Language like that, it tries to make us afraid of embracing our bodies, you know, the whole story of them, their past, present and future, and also the connections that we have between ourselves. Because if you're talking about gestators or menstruators, what do they have in common with a postmenopausal woman that they don't have in common with a man? And you can't articulate that unless we're talking about the body in terms of continuity.
Now, I think on that note, we've run out of time, judging by my clock. I hope I'm right on this one. Victoria, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us this evening. And hopefully you all have your copy of Hags already. If not, get it from your local independent bookshop. Victoria, thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the Intelligence Squared podcast. This episode was produced by Hannah Kay, with editing from me, Catherine Hughes. We'd love to hear your feedback and what you think we should talk about next, who we should have on, and what our future debates should be. Send us an email or a voice note with your thoughts to podcasts@intelligencesquared.com. And if you'd like to hear more, attend some of our live events, or peruse over 20 years of our back catalogue featuring some of the world's greatest minds, then head over to intelligencesquared.com.